am Rabbi Matthew Ponack, and welcome to We're In This Shift Together, an optimistic yet candid collaboration of secular and spiritual discourse, harnessing insights old and new to build bridges towards an adaptive future. My guest today is Shoshana Meira Friedman, a rabbi, writer, mother, and climate activist in Boston. Shoshana and I have known each other for 10 years when we first met in Boulder, Colorado, and later coexisted around the Hebrew College community in Newton, Massachusetts. Welcome, Shoshana.
Thanks so much, Matthew. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you on. And I'd love to hear, just as we get started on our conversation, what called you to be a climate activist, a writer, a rabbi, and a mother? How does a mother fit into that whole journey of your personal calling and your work in the world?
Thank you. That's a great question. I think I'm going to take it in two parts. The calling to become to activate my life force towards climate activism. I've felt a really big sense of urgency and obligation and calling towards environmental work since I was a very small child. I don't actually have a clear moment. I was very, very young and was always deeply empathic towards plants and animals and the more than human world. And to make a very long story shorter, that sense of overwhelm did not really let up until after I majored in environmental studies at Oberlin, and was the year after Oberlin, I did the Join for Justice initiative, the Join for Justice Fellowship, which is a wonderful initiative that trains young adult Jews in the greater Boston area in organizing. And that gave me, for the first time in my life, a sense of, oh, this, I don't have to do this by myself. I mean, it sounds so obvious now that now that I'm almost 40 and have been in movement work for a long time. But as a child and even a teenager, I really thought I somehow had to respond to this deep sense of suffering and imbalance that I could feel in my body was happening in the ecological framework around me, and that I somehow had to respond by myself, which obviously is impossible and exhausting to even think about. So Join for Justice trained me in organizing skills and in power building and in strategy and in movements, and was the first time that I was able to see the bridge between Judaism and my calling to serve the world. I had always felt like they would be connected as a child. I actually articulated that. I have journal entries that articulate that there's something about being Jewish and something about this calling around healing the rift between humanity and the more than human world, that there was something there, but I didn't know what it was. So Join for Justice gave me more of a framework because we studied Jewish texts and we looked at Jewish community and we looked at our own stories. And I learned the importance of grounding myself in my own tradition and in my own lineage in order to then go forth and do more work in the world that would be really meaningful and impactful. I took that and tried the secular environmental world for a little while and honestly just totally burned out spiritually and psychologically and emotionally. And I started to realize that I could not do social change work secularly, that I had to do it as spiritual practice, and I had to do it with others who were also doing it as spiritual practice, and that I needed to be grounded in community that shared some kind of language of the sacred, and also that I needed to just have a home base in my own neshama, in my own soul, of what is the sort of metaphoric spiritual ground I'm standing on as I do work that is so urgent and so vital and ultimately also absolutely not enough. And that's what led me to rabbinical school. It was this hypothesis that maybe by becoming a rabbi, I would both learn enough about Judaism and be grounded enough in community that I would have something to stand on and the strength to then do social change work. I knew that that change work would have to do with ecology and with the more than human world, because that's always how I've been oriented. And it took me a long time to find my footing as a climate activist. Rabbinical school, as Matthew, you know very, very well, is all-encompassing, and it is sort of the most intensive, it's like a schedule like high school, at least at Hebrew College, it's like a schedule like high school, but the workload of a university, and you have adult responsibilities at home. So there's not a lot of room left over during those years for most people to do activism in a really serious way. And that was certainly true for me. So for the 6 years I was studying from 2008 to 2014, I did not have a lot of outlet for this, for the whole reason I'd gone to school, which was so much around this change work and transformation and the shift from, you know, the name of your podcast comes from. And then in 2014, I like to tell the story. It was almost like the 6 years of school, I had been just immersed in this deep well of Torah and of community and of prayer. And it had been this totally immersive experience and it kind of like a cork being held underwater, like maybe a kid playing in a bath. And then when you take your hand off, it just shoots up. And that's a little bit how I felt after school. I shot up into a world where the First People's Climate March was happening and the climate movement was emerging as much more of a, I want to say almost a, not sure this is the right word, but kind of a mainstream social movement where people were starting to really wake up and en masse to the truth that environment was never a dichotomy with humanity, and that caring for each other means caring for our common home and the air and the trees and the networks of water and weather and pollinators and everything that holds us. The world was starting to wake up to that in 2014, that this actually was a human rights issue. And so people who had put themselves in the, I'm not an environment person, like I care about the world, but I'm a human person. I care about social justice. I'm not an environment person. Those people started to wake up to the interconnectedness and see that climate was absolutely an issue of human suffering as well. And so the movement got a lot bigger. And I was ordained right as that was happening. And at the same time, I was invited to speak on a panel at Harvard Divinity School as a Jewish representative and a panel on religion and climate change. And that was an important moment for me because that was a lot of why I had gone to school. It was in order to have the grounding in my own soul and to be able to do social change work in a way that I would not burn out consistently. And it was also to have a platform. It was to have a title before my name and an institution at my back saying, I have access to knowledge and to a credential that people will listen to. And so being on this panel with some luminaries from the interfaith climate movement, who many of whom are still friends and colleagues of mine today, was a way in for me. And it actually opened up a lot of people. I met a lot of people through that event, and it opened up a whole world of interfaith climate activism. And that's been the world that I've been involved in various ways, so many different projects, so many different manifestations, but over the past, whatever, it's been 8 years. And then I can take the second part of your question.
Yeah, please do.
Around motherhood. So I put that in my byline for a couple of reasons. One is because it is a primary way that I spend my time and energy, and I am always wanting to center parenting as a deeply creative spirit and spirit, deeply spiritual practice, and not something that is outside of my work in the world, but very much part of it and a part of being in holy service to the divine, but the divine that lives inside of my child and the divine that lives inside the world that he is navigating, so that my parenting him is part of my social change work and part of my deepest service to God. I also put it in there because my son, I think everybody with any child can put being a parent in their byline, so to speak, and the kid doesn't have to, you know, have any particular special needs, but my son is autistic and his wiring is such that, as somebody said to me once, it's I'm doing upper level parenting. And I really appreciated that frame because I think all parenting is hard and it's intense and it's absolutely to do it with intentionality and with an open heart takes everything that any of us have. And there is something about parenting my particular child that can be a lot more challenging in some ways than parenting other kids might be, and requires of me a depth of presence that I think parenting a neurotypical child would require a different sort of presence and perhaps be, I don't know if the word is easier. I don't think any parenting is easy, but I do. But part of my putting mother in there is to say, like, this is real work. This is incredible. It is one of the most rewarding, and it is certainly the most transformative thing I've ever done. And it's hard, and it is worthy of honor, and it's worthy of being named as such. And then how they come together is, honestly, I would say the crux of so much of my creative work over the past 5 years since becoming pregnant is navigating this journey of how do I raise a child in an unraveling biosphere at the edge of a massive paradigm shift, in the middle of a massive paradigm shift, at the edge of the known world, right? Where we are going into an unknown world, both in the, I think, obviously in the physical biosphere that we live in, and also in as society is going to shift and continue to adapt and go through all the upheavals that we're seeing. What does it mean existentially to choose to become a parent in that context? What does it mean to parent a child well in that context? And I have a piece of writing that I'm hoping will get picked up by a publisher at some point. I've pitched it to one place and I'm waiting to hear back, and then I'll pitch it elsewhere. But it's called Love on a Swiftly Tilting Planet, A Climate Activist Choice to Have a Child. And I don't know if that will, by the time this airs in December, I hope that this piece will be published. And I don't know if that will have been the title, what it is, but it's a short essay and it's about my decision to conceive given everything I know about climate change. And what it ends up coming down to is the phenomenal revelation of love being an underlying reality, and that I spent my childhood feeling the grief and the suffering that humans were causing to each other and to the more than human world, and feeling guilty for having been born. Not because my parents are amazing, and whenever I talk about this, I feel like my parents gave me and continue to give me so much love and support, and I did not get any of this from them. But there's just something about being born into this late capitalism with the awareness of how damaging this economic system is. And for better or worse, I had that awareness at a very, very young age, both I think because of my wiring and a progressive education that I was getting. And so I had a lot of guilt for taking up space, for using resources, for eating, for using water, turning on the car, all of those kinds of things that a kid in the late 90s who cared about the environment was obsessing about. And there's an incredible midrash in our tradition that says, where the rabbis are asking, would it have been better for human beings not to have been created? And they actually come down, the answer is yes. It actually would have been better for us not to have been created, but now that we're here, we should live a good life, and we should right, do right by this life that we are in. And I really resonate. There's a part of me that just so resonates with that, especially the part of me before I had a baby that is really nostalgic. Solastalgia. There's a beautiful word that means this longing for landscape, a longing, a missing of the lived physical natural worlds of that we no longer have or exist in very few places. And anyway, I feel that very much. And so I have been sitting with that sense of maybe I shouldn't have been here at all. And there's a lot of pain there. And I think one of the biggest turning points in my life, possibly the biggest turning point, which then led to having a baby, was the earth loves me. The earth loves us back, as Robin Wall Kimmerer writes. And we are her children. We are not a cancer on this planet. We are cells of the planet. We are part of the planet's intelligence. We are an evolution, a direct result of the evolution of the living biosphere. You know, we are not, I guess there's something about how humanity is talked about, and I think in many ways still is, but certainly in the 90s and early 2000s, of like, I just got the sense that we were somehow these like cancerous aliens that came to some pristine earth, but we didn't really belong here. And over the last 8 years, I've journeyed with psilocybin, and I've meditated, and I've found transcendence in chant, and I've found transcendence in my creative practice and in my gardening. And wow, I'm loved, not just by my parents and not just by my ancestors, but by the earth herself and by God. And don't ask me to try to tease out what's God and what's the earth, because my theology tends to mix them up a lot. In my
so does Kabbalah, family. By the way.
So does Kabbalah, exactly.
Kabbalah will mix those things up as well.
Exactly. And I, my son, we talk a lot about God, and we talk a lot about Mama Earth. And I always call the earth Mama Earth to him, because he calls me Mama. And I want him to always grow up feeling that she loves him and that she is held by him. And so it was really that moment. It wasn't one moment, but it was a finding my way into activism that felt alive and vibrant and exactly where I needed to be. Like my husband, Yotam, good friend of yours, Matthew, he and I.
Yeah, I met you through him, in fact.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So Yotam and I co-wrote a song called The Tide is Rising, and we wrote this in 2015, and it's an anthem for the climate movement, and I'm working on a children's book manuscript version of it. And the tag of the line is, you know, the tide is rising and so are we. This is where we are called to be. And the this being showing up to the climate movement. In the climate justice movement. And this is a very long way of winding around. So I'm coming to pull these ideas together. So it was in finding activism, not from a place of guilt or of me needing to fix things, but actually as a form of devotional practice, that activism is a form of devotional practice. That is a big piece of what helped me feel the earth's love, because it helped me in finding devotion as an orientation to service instead of guilt. As an orientation to service, it freed me to actually feel this flow of love between me and other people, between me and the earth. And once I felt that, then I allowed myself to feel how much I wanted a child, and that having a child, and I'm working on an essay about, this is part of the essay that I mentioned around the choice to have a child, that having a child could be an outpouring of that love, could be an outpouring of the love that the earth feels for me to allow myself to conceive a baby. And so, you know, we were blessed to do so and to have a child. And parenting Abraham, my son, is everything. It's the alpha and omega of my spiritual practice. And he teaches me every day what the work is that we need to be doing in this shift, which is this is obviously not all the work we need to be doing, but it is absolutely foundational to the work, which is to feel our joy and feel our grief and let them be fully emoted in our lived experience and in our bodies, because this is something that my son does so intensely. He feels so intensely. And I parent him, and I thank God for all of the personal work I've done on myself over the years, that I'm able to sit with him when he is devastated that we don't have the right kind of bread for his toast, or when he can't have whatever it is that he wants that is just not physically possible. You know, he'll want me sometimes and I'm just not there, or he'll want, this is an anecdote I've really been thinking about a lot. The other night his banana broke, and it's his bedtime snack, and he doesn't like it when his banana breaks, and we didn't have another banana. And his grief about that, and you know, this is part of his brain's wiring. This is part of how his brain as an autistic brain is wired. It's that his particular brain, and this is obviously not every autistic person, but for him, his verbal intelligence is so beyond his years. It might be, you know, he's 4 and a half. Sometimes it's like talking to a 9 or 10 year old, but his ability to regulate his feelings is much younger than his age. But what we do with him is just be with it and trust that he will actually he will find his way through that grief, the grief that there is no other banana. And it has been something, and this is another piece of writing that I'm working on right now, is that I'm realizing that his grief that there was no other banana is actually the same level of grief that I feel, that there is no other world that is more perfect than ours. And that, like, I desperately want that. We're recording this a few weeks after these horrific slew of mass murders with mass shootings in the United States. And I was in such deep grief in the days following this. And my cries to God, I'm so angry, so freaking angry that this is the world that we're in, that I'm living in a world where children get killed in their classrooms. Where is the different world? How can this be the world I'm in? And so angry and so sad. And then I'm holding Abraham where there is no other banana. And I'm like, this is incredible. He's getting these reps of grief that he's learning to move through. He's learning he can survive it. He's learning that when there is no other banana, he can still keep breathing and living. And honestly, there are days, and there were days after these mass shootings, after, you know, a terrible tragedy or the latest IPCC report around climate change, where there are parts of me that think I can't keep going. And that the fact that there is no other world, I can't bear it. And he teaches me that I can. And my being able to be with him through it teaches me that I can. And what I pray is that my parenting him with compassion through that grief for all these things that a four-year-old in a privileged, healthy world, you know, he is not going through tragedy. And of course, there are children who are in this world, but he is not. But he does have really deep feelings about things that to us seem petty, but they aren't to him. And it means that he's learning how to feel. And that is partly, that's one of the deepest spiritual practices that I have. And I really think that when he's grieving that he doesn't have a different banana, that's spiritual practice. And to be able to sit with a kid and know that he'll be able to find his way through it. And he always does. He absolutely always does. And we will too.
I think that's the trust that Mama Earth has in us. Or if you could say God, that experience of being a parent and begetting children and knowing that it's difficult and knowing also that there's a capability there to thrive and to grow and to evolve. In Kabbalah, as I was referencing earlier, that earth is one of the metaphors for the Shekhinah, right? Land, earth, the planet. And the planet, like the Shekhinah, Kabbalistically gives birth. It springs forth life. And there's something, I think, to be learned from the relationship in, you know, who are our parents, you know, literally and also metaphysically or spiritually. And how does our experience of being a parent, right? And the struggles and also the trust and the growth, right? I think there's a lot to be learned about our understanding of the divine through our experience of parenting as well.
Yes, exactly. And that moment of holding him, I mean, this happens, you know, several times a week at least, but of holding him, one, he's exhausted, it's bedtime, he's, you know, he's hungry, he wants a snack, and he's so upset that there isn't a different banana. And my role of holding him, and I think this was when this happened and partly why it struck me so much, is it was in the middle of the midst of these days where I was in so much grief myself about the world, such active grieving, which, you know, thank God it's not all the time, but surfaces sometimes. And I realized that I was playing the role of God for him, and noticing myself, both the compassion and the heartbreak that I couldn't fix it for him, gave me more compassion for God too, through my own anger. and absolutely, I mean, for me, I would say like earth, it's barely a metaphor. I mean, it is Shekhinah. Like she is, it's just like this is it. This is the, here we are. The bride that keeps on birthing us and holding us.
Yeah, like the gift that keeps on giving.
The gift that keeps on giving, the heart that keeps on breaking, the exile, you know, all of that, the exile and the love and like the radical presence as well as the distance.
Yeah, and the moments of refreshment and real connection. I was really moved by what you were saying in your story about being in a more secular environmentalist scene and noticing that it just burnt you out. I have a great honor of the secular tradition that's arisen and the freedom that it's allowed people to be who they are and the way that it's impacted other religions. And I also know it can be a pretty tough terrain to exist in if that is your sole home. It inherently is more influenced by capitalism, by the algorithm. There's less stability there. And so there are incredible things that come out of that most secular sphere. And there's also a fairly large amount of back and forth and instability that exists there as well. I wanted to ask in sort of, you know, I invite you to reflect on anything I just said, but also I'm curious, what are the ways, and whether they're quote unquote Jewish or newly Jewish or outside of that sphere, that help you tap into the nourishment that you found in juxtaposition to the burnout of the secular
world? Yeah, totally. Well, so I guess what I want to say first is that I think that since some of my experiences that led me to rabbinical school, it's now been 15 years. And I think the movement has changed. I think that that there, if you look at it, I'll talk about my work I'm doing right now supporting Sunrise Movement. But if you look at Sunrise, for instance, the youth movement that's based in the US that is behind the Green New Deal and massive mobilization of youth for climate justice, it is not a religious organization at all, but it is deeply spiritual. And by that, I would say that it's a group that is grounded in people's search for meaning and in their search for belonging and in their search to be of service to that which is most sacred to them. You know, for the Sunrise t-shirt I have is for the, says on the back, for the air we breathe, for the water we drink, for the people we love. Or I can't remember if that's exactly it, but it's in contrast to some of the, let's say, during college back in the early 2000s, where I was doing some canvassing for environmental groups, and there was like an office culture of you weren't allowed to sit down in the office because it was like just keep the adrenaline up to go out and canvass. And there wasn't any grounding in our own personal stories of why are we doing this and what is feeding us. So I want to just preface that by saying that I don't actually think that the dichotomy, and I think you'd agree, I know you would agree with this, Matthew. I'll dare just say I know you'd agree with this, that the dichotomy is not between religious and secular so much as it's between a spiritual orientation of service versus a more capitalist productivity, take everything we can out of us in order to get to our goal.
Yeah, another saying that would be spirituality and materialism.
I think that's a very good way of putting it. Exactly, something like that, exactly. And so I'm very nourished and have deep respect, not just respect, I mean, want to be supporting those frontline climate groups that are not, they're not religious groups, but they are grounded in exactly the stories and the human connections and that sense of transcendent meaning making that is ultimately what drew me to this work. Okay, now will you repeat the...
The other part of the question.
Yeah.
So thank you for responding to the build up to the question.
Yes.
And the question again is, what helps you become refreshed or even joyful, or you know what brings you home in that nourishing way to the source that allows you to continue the work when you're able?
Yes. Okay. Two things come to mind immediately that I want to share. One is that I have been super, super blessed both from privilege that I have the choice and the ability to focus on work that I want to be doing and not to be worried too much about. I've never wanted to have my activism be how I pay the bills. So I just want to say that because it, part of my answer is going to be, I now only do activism that I love doing. So it has stopped being, how do I feed myself in order to do the hard work, and has actually just started to be, I do the work that I find pleasure doing that feeds the movement. And it's all the same work now. And that's pretty incredible. I mean, that has taken years, and it takes continuous refreshing because I'm always changing. The movement is always changing. And what fed me 2 years ago may not now. And so I have to be always listening to my body and to my soul and to the people I'm working with to find where are those spots of like sweet, sweet, sweet synergy. But
it's
letting
almost
go-
a practice of intentional living, right? That's
it's
like the practice
totally.
Is conscious living, life choices that are going to allow for a framework where you can thrive.
Correct. Life choices that allow for a framework where I can thrive. Exactly. And the first big thing that happened was when my son was born, I struggled with both perinatal, prepartum depression and postpartum depression. And so I went down to halftime work. I never thought I would do that. I always thought I'd be sort of salaried high power rabbi. Turns out that did not work for me. And what working part-time allowed for, and again, the privilege of having my husband who's in a field where he can support us financially, which I know, you know, so many people in this country do not have that option to have to be working part-time or to be working minimally in a two-parent household, which is itself obviously part of the awful problem that we're in. But part of what I've been able to do is continuously shift what I'm paying attention to so that what I'm doing is feeding me. And what that has looked like is enough spaciousness that I can parent without feeling completely exhausted, because again, for who my kid is, who my nervous system is, the way that works is I need some downtime and I need to be able to have some spaciousness in order to show up to him in the way that he really needs. And it has looked like letting go of all my preconceived notions of what the quote unquote, like the best or the highest impact activism looks like. I thought for my whole childhood, I was going to go into environmental policy, and like anybody who knows me and knows anything about what it takes to be a policy wonk would be like, what the heck? That it, no. So it turns out that's not my gift. I don't want to be looking at statistics and articles and studies. Like, I'm not an academic, and I'm not a statistician, and I'm not somebody who can thrive on that kind of like deep, deep, deep dive into policy, which is what I always thought was the only way to make a difference. So instead, I've actually paid attention to who I am. Like, this is, if I were to give one big piece of advice to people who are trying to figure out and discern, how do I serve this shift that we're in together? It's pay attention to who you are, like deep attention, not to who you think you should be and not to what you think makes the biggest difference, but to who you actually are, and follow your joy into the spaces of the movements that you're drawn to, because the movements need everything. They, first of all, they need money. And so anything that you do that can be a fundraiser or giving money is helpful. They need writers, they need parents, they need statisticians, they need engineers, they need singer-songwriters, they need public speakers, they need people who can facilitate meetings. I mean, all of these skills that we hold and we think, like, oh, I'm not a real activist, I don't know how to do X, Y, or Z. Actually, a lot of movement spaces need these skills that a lot of us have in other areas of our lives.
I really like what you're sharing there, Shoshana, and I think it's also even broader than quote unquote activist spaces, right?
Completely.
Which probably means something different to you than it means to other people or to me. And just, but that piece of wisdom you just shared, I think is just invaluable in living a life of meaning and being of service to the world, that each of us has a particular gift or set of gifts. And yeah, there's something that the world might need or that we think we should be doing. But if we're coming from a place of authentic joy, then our ability to not get burnt out and to be more brilliant in those spaces can really come to the forefront. And I just wish that's what education looked like, you know, en masse in the world.
Exactly.
That's education. You know,
exactly.
Learning some of the landscape and also being empowered towards self-awareness and defining where we fit in this whole puzzle of our world.
Right, exactly. So if you haven't checked out Pleasure Activism by Adrienne Marie Brown, and she has a wonderful feature article in the latest, or I should say a recent, by the time people are listening to this, Yes Magazine. Yes, this whole idea that following our own pleasure is actually transformative to the world. And that has been such an incredible discovery for me as an activist. So anyway, so
anyone who's like tantric activism.
Completely. It's like, stay in your pleasure zone, just stay there. And there's no, I mean, all I can say, I can only justify for my own life, but this, Adrienne Marie Brown has done this work for years and says, you know, it's been true of everyone she's ever known who's done it. So I'll trust her on that. But for me, looking at statistics and specific policy, not my happy place, but I wrote a song that is feeding the climate movement and helps people stay, you know, march and feel inspired. And I'm a really good public speaker, I'd like to think, and it seems like I am. And so
you
part
are.
Of
if
do,
anyone hasn't met Shoshana before, hear her speak. She's a very good public speaker. She's very powerful and brings a lot of energy. Also a great prayer leader for those who are in that sphere.
And thank you. And like, I say it, I'm sort of, it's funny and very countercultural to just say what you're good at, but I like to share it because it just gives an example of how, like, I thought it was one thing. I really thought it was only going to be, it had to be policy or running for public office. And then I learned that, hey, my nervous system will never be able to sustain running for public office. Good to know. But if you say, write a great song for the climate movement, I can do it with my husband in an evening. And like finesse it over a week. And wow, we just did something great that to me feels easy, but actually isn't that easy for many people. So it's a good thing I did it. And the same with speaking. Like I say, you know, give me shopping for groceries. Very difficult for me. Really exhausting. Brings up so many feelings about our food system, choices, consumerism. Like I come home exhausted. My husband enjoys food shopping. So you know what? He does all the food shopping. And like, let's just give ourselves a break on the stuff that exhausts us, because there are other people where it feeds them. I have a good friend who loves canvassing. So she canvasses. I do not love canvassing, but if you give me 1,000 people to speak in front of, I will not be nervous. So it's like figuring out our this ecosystem that we're in, that works on so many scales, on the personal scale, on the scale of actual ecosystems.
The Torah of the 9 months, which is this midrashic, ancient, right, couple thousand years old, approximately, teaching that in the womb, babies, right, fetuses, before they're born, get an angelic teaching.
We learn it all.
And they learn everything they need to know, and then they sort of get touched on the lip, right, underneath their nose, where that mark is, and that's where that mark comes from, they say. And also they forget everything, but then they can relearn it when they are born. And there's a teaching, a Neo-Hasidic teaching, that the Torah of the 9 months is our Torah, meaning like our passion, our place, our calling. That is what we're learning, and it's that, you know, in that space, in that in-womb space, that we can tap into that central primordial light and see from one end of the universe to the other, as the teaching goes about that light that is beyond time and space. But there's something essential about who we are that we're learning at that moment. And so a lot of the growth that we're doing and the things that we're experiencing and accessing in text or elsewhere, it's actually to kind of get back in touch with who we truly are and what we can be.
Yes, that's beautiful. I mean, it does feel much more like it's remembering. It's not in the deepest sense of that word, you know, remembering, bringing something that was mine into me again or to the surface. I mean, just in terms of the specifics, in case anyone's, on the edge of their chair wondering what I'm spending my time doing these days, as we record, I am doing a lot of writing and creative work and painting. And that to me it's devotional practice. And it is a way, the painting in particular is sort of a pure devotional practice. It's not something that I'm doing really for money or to become famous about, but it feeds me, and I love gifting my pieces, and I love the play. I use alcohol paints, and they're just so playful and fun and vibrant, and it's like dipping into a mystical space of just presence with color. And I garden, which is very similar. I mean, all of my nourishing things are creative pursuits. So gardening, which is like an incredible combination of meditation, being with plants and fungi and small animals, and collage, and cleaning is actually cleaning at one's house, and like decluttering is one of my ways of decompressing, and my writing is also devotional practice, and it is one of the things that I've realized over and over is a way that I can serve the world, because again, it's the stuff that I'm like, how can this be helpful to anyone? I'm having so much fun doing it. Like, you'd think that it's somehow not, how is this social change work if I'm enjoying it so much? And I've just learned over and over and over again that it's the things I enjoy so much, like the juiciest, most, as Adrienne Marie Brown says, like the most erotic, the most embodied, the most raw, that I, like, obvious stuff from my life that I put out there is the most powerfully received and the most needed.
It says in the book of Psalms, and there's a song of many tunes, right? Yivdu et Hashem b'simcha, right? Serve God with joy. And that is such a central component of what I hear you saying, that service maybe in the oldest sense meant sort of the temple service or something, right? Bringing the offerings. And also, I think it pretty much has always meant like doing the work that we're being called to do here.
Exactly.
And to do it with joy I almost said it's a high level, but it's also like an essential level, right? It's something like, that we should all be striving for.
It's something that our teacher, the teacher that we share, Rabbi Sharon Cohen Anisfeld, says, and I, this is not actually her quote, so now we'd have to find who she's quoting, but I know it from her. So it's that I have very little use for simplicity on this side of complexity, but simplicity on the far side of complexity is the most, is so useful and so brilliant. And I think that for me, coming into this space of joy and service is simplicity on the far side of complexity, and that I've had to go through so much complex personal growth, so much letting go of all of the shoulds, so much unlearning, and so much paying attention to who I actually am in order to get to the liberation that is found on that far side of complexity, to be like, oh, actually, I love to write and I love to speak and I love to be around kids. Like, I guess that's just what I'm going to do.
That's wonderful. It It reminds me of the Garden of Eden story, actually, which one of the ways that I understand that is it was so simple at first. There was one commandment, don't eat the forbidden fruit. That's all it was. Just, hey, exist, be in paradise, basically, and don't worry about the rest of it, but just don't eat that fruit. And it is my opinion that they were meant to eat the fruit because they hadn't done any work yet. And my hope is that one day humanity, the planet, the universe can return to an Edenic state, but one that comes on the far side of complexity, this great aha moment that with never ending gratitude for all that we've made it through. And Shoshana, I'm aware that there's a limit of time for our conversation. I'm really cherishing all of this. And I want to make sure a couple things. There's a couple texts I want to show you before we end, but I also want to ask you about your current work. If you could comment both on your artistic Beit Midrash, which is really interesting, and I'm just learning about it, and also on your work with Sunrise. And there's one other kind of question I want to throw in here. You don't have to answer it, but I'm curious about your experience of growing up with a progressive mindset and feeling guilt and having to take a long time to work through that vis-a-vis reflections you might have about pedagogy or parenting in general around children. Like, when is the time to present the facts or the drama that we're living in right now? And when is the time to build a relationship with the garden? And I'll leave it up to you to answer all of these things. Great. I just asked, and choose how you want. But these are some of the things that are on my mind as we're coming to an end of our conversation.
So essentially, what do I spend most of my waking hours thinking about in 5 minutes?
Ten minutes.
Great questions. So I will highlight four projects I'm working on right now. I'll do them quickly. So first of all, in terms of climate activism, Dayenu, a Jewish call to climate action, I would urge any listeners who are Jewish or Jewish adjacent to please check out Dayenu.org. Dayenu as in the Passover song. This is a incredibly important and growing Jewish organization that is confronting the climate crisis with bold political action and spiritual audacity. And this is the first and at this point only Jewish organization that is multi-generational systemic climate activism, meaning we're targeting the root causes of the crisis and not only Dayenu doesn't focus at all on individual actions or greening institutions or environmental education, all of which are great and important, but much of the Jewish environmental world has been there for many years, and Dayenu adds to it this systemic activism. So we've done Get Out the Vote campaigns, we've done lots of mobilization activism around the Build Back Better Act, which is a major, you know, initiative in the national level, at the federal level in the United States. We're currently working on All Our Might, which is a project around moving money. And stopping, it's called Stop the Money Pipeline, which is an international push around trying to stop fossil fuel projects instead of going the legislative route, which obviously we need to be going that route, but it's very slow and difficult. Try to cut off fossil fuel projects by stopping the money that's funding them. And that comes from banks and insurance institutions. Those are corporations. They can make decisions much more quickly than the US federal government. So we're right now focusing on that angle of things. And Dayenu is really exciting because it's broad-based, it's grassroots, it's built on Dayenu circles, which are groups of Jews together doing this work and being part of campaigns that are designed by the national team, which has incredible staff with decades of organizing experience. So I'm a rabbinic ambassador for Dayenu, which means that I do public speaking. If anyone wants to bring me in on Zoom to speak for your congregation or group, I do that regularly.
Or to here on Vancouver Island, where you can witness one of the parts of the world that is much of which is untouched and beautiful.
That would
be
incredible.
Anyone's listening.
Exactly. And just if you do that, go to wren.com, WREN.com to buy offsets for your travel. So that's one big piece. I work on building the Jewish climate movement through public speaking. Another big climate related project I'm doing, and I'm hopeful by the time people are listening to this, that this will have launched quite successfully. So the Sunrise Movement, which is the youth movement behind the Green New Deal and phenomenally successful, large momentum style climate movement based in the US. I'm too old to be a leader in that movement because it ages out at 35. It's a youth movement. And it was founded, it became public really the year I turned 35. And I've always been a huge fan. And, you know, now that you know a bit of my story, it would make sense when I say Sunrise is the movement I always needed. They touch a real nerve in the deepest, most beautiful way for me, because it's that those are the people that I needed as a child, and I didn't have those peers around me. So I have a deep and abiding respect and personal connection to Sunrise through that. And what I'm doing right now is working with their national fundraising team to launch, and hopefully it will have launched, and it will, the link will be in the show notes, a Sunrise Giving Circle model, so that those of us who are mostly over 35, although if you're younger than 35 and you're, and this makes sense for you, then that's great too, who are awake to the climate crisis, you know, kept up at night by it. Many of us have young children. We're not able to take the physical risks of risking arrest, putting our bodies on the line, or the amount of time that a lot of frontline activists need to do because we've chosen to have a child, or because we have careers that we aren't willing to walk away from, or just doesn't make sense for us to walk away from. We are realizing that the climate movement and Sunrise needs money, and that there are actually very, very talented organizers doing this work, and they don't need us to quit our jobs. They need financial resources to do their work.
They need you to be fulfilled in your role.
They need me to be doing what I'm doing, and I need them to be doing what they're doing. And I have inherited wealth from white privilege and the whole financial situation of being a third generation white Jew in America. In my family, that meant that there was an accumulation of wealth, some of which has been passed down to me. My husband is making good money, and we have more money than we have time, and we have so much desire to be of radical service to this movement. And I'm not alone in this. I know there's actually a whole demographic of people, many of whom are my friends and who have friends, who you don't even have to have inherited wealth or a lot of financial security, but to make a stretch gift. So the idea is that with these circles, people join together, they make a group of friends, everybody would make a stretch gift, or I prefer to call it an investment. They would invest some amount of money in Sunrise Movement and invite their friends and family to do the same, an amount that is doable for them, but is a little bit of a stretch, something that signals that they are taking a risk and putting their money where their mouth and their heart is. And then the group together, the circle together, would have a cumulative fundraising goal. And the first group that has done this, that has not yet been replicated, and what we're working on doing is building out a prototype for this. Their original goal was to raise $50,000, and this group of friends ended up raising $250,000 over the course of a few months by tapping into their networks, because this hits such a nerve with people, because we are all wanting to do more than we're doing. And what they did was they invested what they would have put into their retirement, they put into Sunrise, into a world worth retiring in, and investing in a livable future instead of only in their own personal retirement funds. So this is a whole framework for rethinking climate giving, not as philanthropy, but as investment, and thinking of it as a way to be of real service to the movement. And I'm really excited to be building out that model. And the last thing I'll say around the fourth one is that I'm working on this children's book version of The Tide is Rising. It's really a partisan song. I'm expanding the verses so that they are, you know, you read it's the marching song of the rebels in the forest. It's like, this is who we are. This is how the movement, this is who the movement is. The going is rough, but we're in it, and we're in it together. And we are the immune system of the earth, and we are rising up. And I firmly believe, not just believe, but experience in my own body and in the children that I've worked with, not just my own kid, that kids, they're getting the science. They're getting the science in school. They're getting the science from the news. They know climate change is bad. What they're not getting, and what they desperately need, what all of us need, is a sacred story to put themselves in that lets them keep showing up day after day to their lives, knowing that there is meaning, that there's meaning in the struggle, that there's meaning in what they are in joining together with other people, regardless of the tangible campaigns that we win. There, which we will have wins and losses, the struggle itself is a hero's journey. And so I'm trying to frame the climate movement as this collective hero's journey, and doing that through a book. So I'm going to be pitching it to agents and publishers in the coming months, and we'll see how it goes.
Well, b'hatzlacha, as they say.
May
you have success, good luck. But I also heard a teaching from our teacher, Nehemiah Pohl, and Rabbi Nehemiah Pohl, and that it's related to a root word that means something like bursting or breaking open. So Bahatzlacha, he said, in Hasidic language means, may you have a breakthrough. Into the next phase. So yes. Break on through to the other side,
thank
Shoshana.
You.
So we're going to end our conversation right here. And for those listening, I have a side series, a bonus episode series that hopefully by the time this episode comes out will have begun. And it is studying Torah texts, usually mystical texts, but sometimes other things with my guest. And that will come out on YouTube, and that will come out also in a bonus podcast episode. And so Rabbi Shoshana Friedman and I are going to be discussing that text in another segment. But for now, I'd like to thank you so much for this conversation. It was incredibly rich, Shoshana. I feel like there is a desire I have to talk more and more, and just to appreciate all of your passion and everything else that you are bringing to this work. I want to ask, if someone wants to check out what's going on for you or get updates, where's the best place for them to find you on the internet?
Yeah, thank you. So you can follow me on Instagram at Rabbi Shoshana, RabbiShoshana. And I'm also RabbiShoshana.com for links to my organizations that I'm working with and projects and articles.
Fantastic. Well, I'm Rabbi Matthew Ponak. Thanks for listening to We're In This Shift Together. Until next time, may you find your true calling and what brings you joy. And from that process and that knowledge, may you come to a place of true service and work in the way that only you can.